Today's talk is called Meeting Spiritual Friends. Meeting Spiritual Friends. So I started to get involved with Buddhism around 1974, when I was about 17 years old. And it's hard to say quite when my interest in Buddhism began. There was a whole series, a whole network of events that brought me to Buddhism, to the Dharma. There was no Buddhism at all in my family. I was brought up in a family of church-going, Church of England people. My parents and sisters and myself went to church on Sundays, working-class family. There was no Buddhism in my village in Sussex. And as far as I could tell, there was no Buddhism in the town near to my village, which was Brighton on the Sussex coast. I wasn't that bookish in those days, and there didn't seem to be any books on Buddhism around. I certainly didn't notice any, not that I went into bookshops that would have books on Buddhism. And certainly in the 1970s, Buddhism had a much lower profile than it does now. My arrival at Buddhism came really, I would say, if this doesn't sound too grandiose, out of the awakening of a sort of spiritual longing. I kind of knew very early on in my life that I couldn't or I wouldn't be like my parents or my sisters. I didn't think I'd get married, and I didn't think that I'd do a normal job. I think that's probably normal when you're a child, but I certainly felt that. And a kind of spiritual longing for something different was around in me. Christianity somehow was very unsatisfying. It seemed so sort of straight and conventional and social, in spite of the beautiful old churches that I went to in Sussex, really lovely churches, I love them very much. There didn't seem to be much spiritually going on. I wasn't responsive to Christ. Christ Jesus never did anything for me, really. And I didn't really have, I couldn't really believe in a creator God. That didn't seem to make sense. It wasn't sort of immediately apparent. And I did think when I was quite young, well, if there's no God, how is a spiritual path possible? I'd never come across the idea of a spiritual path without God. Music was very important to me. Music had a very big effect and contributed a great deal to my spiritual quest. I graduated in my early teenage years from prog rock, progressive rock, I won't mention the names, to jazz. Jazz was incredibly important, especially mid-60s American jazz. That was a great revelation to me, especially the music of John Coltrane, tenor saxophone player. To me, that was deeply spiritual music, listening to some of John Coltrane's stuff. That just went straight to the heart, that just opened up the heart. I used to go into, literally, sort of meditative ecstasy, listening to mid-60s John Coltrane, A Love Supreme, things like that. Really had a very, very powerful effect on me. And of course, Coltrane himself was very interested in Eastern religion. I remember one album I had of his, he was chanting the mantra Om over and over again, and other jazz people like Don Cherry were really into, seemed to be into Buddhism and Hinduism and things like that. The first time I heard the Shakyamuni mantra was on a Don Cherry album called The Relativity Suite. Great album, fantastic. Anyway, going off the point. But eventually this got me kind of moving towards to Buddhism. I went into a bookshop in Brighton. I was starting to get into bookshops then. And I asked the guy working in the bookshop, it's a really good bookshop called Symposium, if he had any books on Tibetan Buddhism. And he pointed me towards the writings of Lama Anagarika Govinda, the great German Buddhist who has regarded himself as part of a Tibetan order, and particularly his book Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. That was the first book on Buddhism that I read when I was about 16, 17. And I can't claim that I understood any of it. But I found it completely thrilling. I actually enjoy reading books that I don't understand. I find that very exciting. I found this book thrilling because, and looking back, what I think came out of it were vivid descriptions of a spiritual path, descriptions of higher states of consciousness, which sounded so attractive. Descriptions of wisdom. It was visionary as well. I mean, wonderful sort of passages describing sort of symbolic experience. And throughout the book, and these were as important as the text, are these lovely, beautiful black and white photographs that Lee Gotami, Lama Govinda's wife, took of these images in these temples in Western Tibet. Wonderful images of Amitabha in Amoga City. Really mysterious. Looking images, just in black and white, they communicated so much. Kind of seeing these things just drew me into this world. A kind of whole world of spiritual life seemed to be evoked through Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism. And a sense of it being kind of open-ended. There was no kind of ceiling to it, because one thing I clocked was the fact that there's no God. I mean, Govinda made that very clear. There's no creator. All this is possible because of our potential as human beings. Of course, it communicated a very different vision of human life. Not human as we usually understand it, Jim. Star Trek moment there. Something much, much deeper and richer and extraordinary. And it was quite clear, the other thing that was quite clear that Lama Govinda communicated was that all this is attainable. All this is realisable in your life. And there were two things that he emphasised. Meditation. All this is possible through meditation. He didn't describe any practices, but he made it clear that there are practices, methods, to effect entry into this world. And Govinda mentioned especially the esoteric and tantric meditation practices, which of course I found especially appealing. These fast, exotic methods where you would be catapulted into these realms of bliss, mystery and infinite depth. And secondly, Lama Govinda really emphasised the importance of a teacher, a guru. A guide who would teach you meditation and introduce you to these special practices, who would give you initiations, which would somehow introduce you directly to this realm. And this led me to Lama Govinda's other very famous book, The Way of the White Clouds. Very beautiful book indeed. This is an autobiographical book by and large. And it mainly describes Lama Govinda's journeys in Tibet and Western Tibet, his expedition with his wife to document these old temples in Western Tibet. Very moving descriptions of what they did in these old temples, trying to copy the frescoes before they were lost, photographing images and so on. But more importantly for me, his encounter with his meetings with various gurus. Tibetan gurus, Tibetan lamas. These were amazing. These beings of great spiritual power, these living embodiments of wisdom and compassion, who had the ability, it seemed, to just spark you off and introduce you directly to the enlightened state, was so attractive to, you know, a young lad living with his parents in a semi-detached in Sussex. Very attractive, beguiling. And of course, I wanted such a guru. I longed for such a guru and those special practices. I wanted that special teaching that would, through some mysterious, powerful, magical process, introduce me directly to enlightenment. And then, of course, it would be easy. It would be smooth. The vision would just unfold. I wouldn't mind what kind of effort I would make because, you know, it would just be happening. Interesting that. Anyway, There then followed quite a painful period for me, lasting a few months. I very much wanted to meditate, but I didn't know what to do to meditate. I'd sit cross-legged in my room, getting into all sorts of weird postures, waiting for something to happen. Meanwhile, I was reading more Buddhist books. At some time around this time, I read The Life of Milarepa, the great teacher of Gampopa, actually. And again, Milarepa's life story, this great hermit and yogi, really emphasizes the guru and the teacher and meditation. I collected Buddhist images and reproductions of Tibetan tankas. My whole room became a sort of shrine room, much to the consternation sometimes of my parents. I remember writing off to a Buddhist monastery. I'd heard about a Buddhist monastery in Scotland, and I found it addressed, and I wrote a very, very heartfelt letter. Alas, there was no reply. Eventually, by chance, I found out about a Buddhist group meeting in Brighton, my local town, and I went along one Saturday afternoon as soon as I heard about this place. And I met, it was just an ordinary house, and I met some very friendly people, a husband and wife and their children. And they told me about the classes they held there, and that I could come back in a few days' time. And they told me about the person who ran the class, told me his Indian name, which I didn't catch. And of course, I couldn't wait. The next few days seemed to go very slowly because would this be my guru? I mean, that was the way I thought. I am going to meet my guru. This could be the one. This could be the man who will give me the special teaching. And the day came, and I was excited and eager, and I went to the place. And I have to say, kind of inevitable, really, the first meeting at first was disappointing. At first, because the person who said hello to me had, you know, he must have been in his, I don't know, early 30s. He was wearing a very ordinary sort of sweater, brown coloured sweater and jeans. Seemed very British, friendly, formal, nice handshake, very ordinary. There was no special teaching given to me. It was all very low key. I was just meeting an ordinary man. This man's name was Buddhadasa, a member of the Western Buddhist Order who's still a very good friend of mine. Later on, we had the class. We went into the shrine room in this house. And Buddhadasa explained the Metta Bhavana. We did a long meditation. It seemed like an eternity. It was very difficult. I found it very hard just to sit still. And then we did the puja. So this is my first night at a Buddhist centre. There was no gradual introduction. We did the sevenfold puja. And the puja was wonderful. Really very, very wonderful doing the puja. I felt that I was speaking my language. I was in my world. I felt somehow completely at home in this world. I somehow knew while I was doing the puja, and this was a much more of a sort of wordless realization. It wasn't, I didn't really think it, but I kind of knew I'd devote my life to Buddhism. I didn't know why I knew that, and I didn't know how I would do that, but I kind of knew it. It wasn't some sort of mind-blowing realisation or anything like that. It was very, very ordinary. But I kind of knew it. And I did. I just plunged into Buddhism after that. I learned the different meditation practices. Eventually, I came across Sangharakshita. Buddhadasa, member of our order, knew Sangharakshita personally, was a personal disciple of him. And he'd play some of Sangharakshita's tape lectures at another class that he started. And, you know, there were a few of Sangharakshita's books available, not many, one or two. And I just took them all in, and I really loved Sangharakshita's lectures. Very clear, direct teaching, also very inspirational. You know, his early lectures in particular, went a lot of energy in them. And again, I was completely thrilled the more I kind of heard Sangharakshita's lectures, especially his tantric series of lectures. And I began to regard him as my teacher. And I remember when he came to, by this time I moved in with Buddhadasa in the little community that he'd started in Brighton. and he'd started his own centre. And Sangharakshita came for a visit, and I was so excited again. Now, this really is the guru. The guru is coming. And again, the meeting was kind of disappointing. He was very ordinary, very low-key indeed. And there was no way that, you know, you're going to be able to do a prostration or make an offering. It was a very, very ordinary meeting. You know, kind of underwhelming, really. But there were a few little incidents. I won't go into those. Very interesting ones. But anyway, that was the first impression. But whatever, I got more involved. Much more deeply involved through studying Buddhist texts, through practicing the meditations. I got involved, in other words, in the Sangha that Sangharakshita had started, the spiritual community that he'd started. And eventually I was ordained by Sangharakshita into the Western Buddhist Order. I got to know him a bit personally. And ordination, when I was ordained in 1976, that was my actual commitment to the Buddhist path. I went for refuge, as we say, to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And so for the last 30 years, I've been active in this Sangha, in this order. My spiritual practice takes place in this context. These are my spiritual friends in this Sangha, this community, which is an ever-widening circle of spiritual friends, because as a spiritual community, we are, you know, very active, as I think you know. Now, I started with this fragment of autobiography because it relates directly to the chapter of Gampopa's Dual Liberation that we're considering today. This is chapter 3. We're only up to chapter 3. Meeting Spiritual Friends. Chapter 3, Meeting Spiritual Friends. And Gampopa says at the beginning, the contributory cause for liberation from bewilderment and suffering, the contributory cause are spiritual friends. This means, he says, that although you may possess the most perfect working basis, if you are not urged on by, if you're not encouraged by spiritual friends as a contributory cause, it is difficult to set out on the path towards enlightenment because of the power of inveterate propensities due to evil deeds committed repeatedly in former times. Therefore, you have to meet spiritual friends. Gampopa is, of course, teaching and practicing and living and operating in the traditional Tibetan context. He has no doubt that we are lost and confused and weighed down by the effects of past actions. This can sound a bit heavy. I'm going to talk a little bit about karma tomorrow, karma and rebirth, just a little bit. A bit heavy, and maybe we don't relate to it because we don't relate to the notion of previous lives and all that. But certainly we can feel sometimes lost and confused and longing for some sort of guidance, some light to be shed on our lives, a fresh light, a different kind of perspective, or just some sort of instruction. We want to know what to do. This was my own experience. I wanted to do something with my life. I wanted to live a spiritual life, devote myself to a spiritual life. Some sort of faith in a Buddhist life had been woken up, had opened up. I really wanted that Buddhist life, and I wanted guidance from an actual person. I wanted another human being to talk to communicate with, who had some experience. The books were great, they were inspirational, they gave good instruction, but they weren't enough. I wanted a living teaching, a living communication with someone who was doing it. And I can very confidently say that unless I'd met spiritual friends, I would not have become a Buddhist. I've got absolutely no doubt about that. I wouldn't have followed a Buddhist path. My interest would have faded away. My own habits, especially laziness and inertia in my case, would have been overwhelming. I'm not a particularly ambitious or adventurous person, in fact. A friend of mine said that I'm a bit like a hobbit the other day. And I think I know what he means. The preferred to sort of stay at home, really. I've no doubt if I hadn't met spiritual friends, I would have just followed the line of least resistance. Sometimes people, they for some reason or other, they hear me give talks and they think, oh, you know, he's so incredible, Padmavajra. I mean, I say that not as self-aggrandizement, but I mean, people do think it. And they say, well, what do you think you would have done if you hadn't become a Buddhist? You know, and they think I'm going to say, oh, you know, I would have been a poet or a painter. And I said, well, no, it's nothing like that. I would have led a very boring life. You know, I've said before, some of my friends know this, I would have, you know, married and settled down in the village, become a plumber like my dad, probably that was the family business. You know, played football every week, and, you know, at about 50, which I am now, I would have sort of wondered, oh, what were those feelings I had all those years ago? And I've no doubt that whatever is good that I've experienced spiritually is because of my meeting with spiritual friends. I've got no doubt about that. Spiritual friends urge us on, says Gampopa. They encourage us. Not necessarily directly. They don't just keep telling us what to do all the time. A spiritual friend isn't a nag, although sometimes they might be quite challenging on occasion. You just need to be around them. You just need to be around other Buddhists who are actually practicing, who stimulate you and support you. They do that just through their practice. It's very easy to drift away, to get distracted, to forget the Dharma, to forget one's purpose in life. And just being around spiritual friends keeps that alive. In his text, Gampopa discusses the importance of spiritual friends in the following way. He first of all talks about the reason why they're so important. Secondly, the different kinds of spiritual friends and the qualities of each of them. Thirdly, the ways in which you stay in touch with spiritual friends, the way you communicate with them. And fourthly, he describes the benefits of having spiritual friends. So I'll just go through these. Gampopa's discussion is very, very traditional, of course, reflecting the conditions of 11th century Tibet, which was a more or less feudal society, a hierarchical society, where formal and vertical relationships are part of the scene. There's, you know, we're not talking about a democratic environment at all. Your spiritual friend is a guru who is really your lord and master. Our circumstances are, of course, very, very different. And I don't believe it's possible or desirable to replicate what Gampopa describes, everything that Gampopa describes in our context. I think I might come to this point again a bit later. Having said that, there are important principles that inform Gampopa's discussion of spiritual friends. So I want to explore what he has to say. First of all, the reason why spiritual friends are so important. The first reason is a very traditional explanation. Gampopa says spiritual friends are important because of scriptural authority. Scriptural authority. They're important because they're recommended so strongly, so regularly in Buddhist, canonical, and commentarial literature. For Gampopa, the Buddha and the great teachers of the tradition are an authority. Not in the sense of being authoritarian, but in the sense of possessing tremendous spiritual weight. So when a text says that all the virtues of a wise man spring from having spiritual friends, who you are in touch with and who you revere. Well, for Gampopa, that is the way it is. That is the way it is because the Buddha and the great teachers say it's like that. We won't necessarily regard the Buddhist texts in that way. So I'm not sure that we can appeal to this. But it's interesting to reflect that no Buddhist tradition has ever doubted the importance of spiritual friends and of spiritual teachers. you probably formed the image of a Buddhist as being somebody who's very solitary, who spends all their time meditating in forests and caves and keeping silent and things like that. And if they are practicing with others, well, they hardly anything is said. But even with the traditions of solitary and spiritual practice, all that would happen in the context of having a teacher and having spiritual friends. And you would be very aware of them in your solitary retreat, even when you haven't seen them for years and years on end. The great Milarepa, Gampopa's teacher, spent years and years and years in solitary meditation. And in his spiritual songs, he always begins by recalling his teacher, Marpa. He expresses devotion and gratitude, and he says he always imagines his teacher above the crown of his head. So his teacher, his spiritual friend, is a constant presence, even when he's in his solitary retreat. Sometimes you even find Milarepa singing about his fellow disciples of Marpa. He's imagining them practicing puja together. So he thinks of his fellow disciples, his friends. The second reason, Gampopa says, why spiritual friends are so important is because of necessity. This is Gunther's translation. Other translations say because of logic. The point here is a very simple one. You don't know how to gain enlightenment. You don't know the path to enlightenment. You don't know the practices. So it's self-evident that you need someone who can show you how to do it, who can show you the path, and who can teach you the practices. And, you know, again, I can refer back to my own experience. I didn't know how to actually practice. Reading Buddhist books, I was shown a map, and I was certainly inspired to go on the journey, but until I met spiritual friends, I didn't actually know how to step on to that journey. The third reason that Gampopa gives is through the use of similes. Spiritual friends, he says, are like guides when we travel in unknown territory. Secondly, they're like escorts when we pass through dangerous regions. And thirdly, they're like a ferryman when we cross a great river. And these, of course, are very ancient, even archetypal images for the spiritual friend, the spiritual guide. And of course, they're not just Eastern images, they're universal images of the guide. So let's just contemplate them a little. First of all, says Gampopa, if we travel without a guide in unknown lands, there is the great danger of getting lost. And of course, Gampopa is speaking in a time and a place where there were very few maps and it was very dangerous to travel. You could easily fall down a ravine or get lost in some forest or in some mountain range or something like that. So travel was very dangerous in his time. People would often not reach their destination. If we have a guide, someone who knows the way, who knows the terrain, we can reach our destination. So in the same way, it's very easy to get lost when you embark on a spiritual path. You might be inspired to do it, but it's very easy to lose your way. Gampopa says it's easy to get distracted by other paths, other traditions, which are a sort of distraction from the path to enlightenment. Or you might be satisfied with lesser attainments. You only go part of the way. So you need a spiritual friend to keep you on the right track. What this means is that a true spiritual friend provides clarity and direction. He cuts through your confusion. He cuts through when you're rationalizing your laziness and your tendency to settle down and make yourself comfortable. He gets you out of ruts that you might have got stuck in and pulls you out of cul-de-sacs that you've gone down. Secondly, a spiritual friend is like an escort, a guard, a protector even. So Grandpa says, supposing we wander in dangerous regions, haunted by thieves, robbers, wild beasts, and other noxious animals. If we go there without a guard, an escort, there is a great danger of being robbed, attacked, murdered. And Gampopa would know all about these dangerous, lawless places. From the old Tibet, I mean, it seems banditry was very, very common. In the same way, a spiritual friend is a protector, a guard, an escort on the spiritual path. He protects us against the loss of our spiritual momentum and our spiritual vision. It's very easy to lose these things, actually. We can often think that we've got them. We've got it sussed. You know, we've got that spiritual momentum. We've got it all worked out. We have our spiritual riches. Especially perhaps, you know, when we're on retreat, when the conditions are so good, we can be very much in touch with our spiritual life, our spiritual practice. And maybe that goes on for a few days, even a few weeks afterwards. And we can start thinking, yeah, I've got this completely sorted out. I don't need to be with spiritual friends anymore. But we need to understand, until the arising of wisdom, deep, profound wisdom into the true nature of things, until we've entered the stream that only leads to enlightenment, it's very, very easy to lose whatever we've attained. Our attainments are often impermanent, not lasting attainments. So spiritual friends protect us against the loss of what we've achieved. He keeps reminding us, urging us to practice. He protects us against ourselves. He protects us against powerful emotions, wrong views and circumstances that can destroy our spiritual lives, which are like robbers and murderers. We can be overwhelmed sometimes in our spiritual practice by, you know, very painful emotions. Sometimes we can get very frightened when we practice a spiritual life because our idea of ourselves is breaking down, and we want to give it up. Well, a spiritual friend gives us the gift of fearlessness and protects us, you know, from emotions like that, so our spiritual life isn't destroyed. Thirdly, spiritual friends are like ferrymen. It's a lovely image, lovely ancient image of the ferry boat and the ferryman. Used to be ferries on the river here, the pub down the road called the Surlingham Ferry. That was an old ferry, lovely. And again, Gampopa would know about this. You know, he'd know about going on a ferry across the great rivers like the Brahmaputra in Tibet. You need an expert ferryman to cross the river, to cross the flood, to cross the samsara, the wheel of life, the wheel of our habits based on ignorance is likened to a great flood. It's easy to be swept away, to be swallowed up by it. We can feel this sometimes. It's easier to see sometimes in other people. You can see the sort of tragedy of somebody's life where the weight, the power, the flood of the past just sweeps away their best efforts. It's the stuff of tragedy, of great drama, isn't it? So spiritual friends are like ferrymen, like boatmen. They help you cross the flood so that you're not swept away by your habits. The similes, of course, they are similes, so they're not to be taken literally. And the last especially could sound, if you take it literally, it could sound as though you're passive. You're just sort of passively going along with the boatman. And it's not like that. We have to remember, it's we that have to practice, that have to make the spiritual effort. As the Buddha says, it's by you that the zealous effort should be made. The Buddhas only point the way. So we have to remember that. We are making the spiritual effort. But spiritual friends can guide, can protect, can sort of pilot us on our journey. But in the end, it's always ourselves that practices. So in all these similes, the spiritual life is likened to a journey in dangerous, unknown lands across potentially dangerous waters. and spiritual friends are guiding, protecting, encouraging and reassuring us. So that's the three similes for spiritual friends as one of the reasons why spiritual friends are so important. Then Gampopa moves on to an explanation of the different kinds, the different levels of spiritual friends. And we encounter these different kinds of spiritual friends at different stages in our spiritual progress. First of all, there is the spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. This is the kind of spiritual friend that we will meet first of all. And why is that? Well, because we can't see any other kind of spiritual friend. I'll say more about that a bit later. As we grow and develop spiritually, we encounter other spiritual friends. We can encounter bodhisattvas on a high level of spiritual attainment. A bodhisattva is someone dedicated to enlightenment for the benefit of all. And here is meant someone very highly developed along that path. Thirdly, we can meet the spiritual friend in the form of the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha. There's Buddhist technical language here. Let's just keep it simple. The Nirmanakaya, we could say, is the Buddha in physical form. So it's meeting the Buddha as spiritual friend. Then, we can go even further. There's the spiritual friend as the Sambhogakaya. The Sambhogakaya, again, keeping it simple, means something like the archetypal body of the Buddha. We can meet the Buddha in visionary form. He can become our spiritual friend. Of course, these last three sound very attractive. We want that spiritual friend, these deep mystical spiritual friendships. That's what we want, probably. We want the bodhisattvas on the high level of spiritual attainment. We want the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha. We want the Sambhogakaya of the Buddha. They would be fantastic spiritual friends. Wow. Relates to my own experience, my desire for a guru. What I wanted was the special, esoteric, spiritual guide and teacher revealing the special mysteries of existence to me, who would be the great disciple, the special disciple. Not so fast. Interestingly, Gampopa doesn't say so much about the last three kinds of spiritual friends. He does say that they will be found when the darkness of our previous deeds has been dispelled, and when we've gone along the great preparatory path, when we've risen to a high spiritual stage, then we can encounter these kinds of friends. He does describe the qualities of bodhisattvas who dwell on a high spiritual level, but he doesn't sort of dwell on them very much. Gampopa, I think, doesn't flatter our conceit, our vanity, our desire to be special by speaking about the very advanced kinds of spiritual friends. He's concerned with our spiritual practice right now. So he brings us down to earth and says these wonderful words. Should you ask, who among these four kinds of spiritual friends is our greatest benefactor? The reply is that in the beginning of our spiritual career, when we are still living imprisoned by the effects of our deeds and defilements, we will not even see so much as the face of those higher spiritual friends. Instead, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can illumine the path we have to follow with the light of his counsel. Later, we will meet the higher spiritual friends. Therefore, the greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. The greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. You may remember that when I told you that little bit from my life story, I was underwhelmed by the ordinariness of my first encounters with my spiritual friends. Buddhadasa in his sweater and jeans, Sangharakshita in a rather dull, shabby raincoat. Very ordinary indeed. But in fact, that is precisely what I needed. I needed to meet people, men of their time and place, who were actually living a viable spiritual life in the 20th century, in 20th century Britain. This is what we, in fact, need to begin with. Yes, there are indeed deeper levels of spiritual friendship that you can encounter, and they're a source of great richness and inspiration. It's good to know that they're there, and it's important to open up to them. But they open up, first of all, in the context of relating to spiritual friends in the form of ordinary human beings. And Gampopa gives a description of the qualities of spiritual friends in the form of ordinary human beings, drawing on traditional sources. And some of these descriptions themselves are rather exalted. They are actually descriptions of somebody highly spiritually developed. I'll give you the briefest of those descriptions, or the first of them. And I'm going to mention it because, well, maybe some of you are thinking, or maybe I'll be a spiritual friend one day. Maybe you are already a spiritual friend to people. Well, here's a little verse on what it means to be a spiritual friend. To be very learned, to dispel doubts, to be agreeable, and to point out reality are the most perfect instructive qualities. So to be very learned. You know the Dharma in breadth and depth. You need to know the Dharma in breadth and depth because you meet people in all sorts of different states and people go through different states. So you need to introduce them to the range of the Dharma. You need to have available to you all the different teachings for the different kinds of individuals that you meet. The spiritual friend dispels doubts. By doubts, what is meant here are those pernicious hindrance that we have, where we have doubt about ourselves, about our capacity to practice, we lack confidence, we have doubt about whether spiritual practice is actually possible. Well, the spiritual friend can dispel those doubts, not through giving you a lecture and a ticking off, but through the natural confidence born of his insight, the natural confidence that he has in the spiritual life. He dispels your doubts in that way. He can dispel your doubts as well because he's a clear thinker. The spiritual friend is agreeable. I take agreeable to mean that he's friendly, helpful, approachable, easy to get into communication with, easy to be with. It's very easy to be with such a person. You can open up to them quite easily. They point out reality. They can point directly to the truth, spark you off into a realization of the truth. Apparently Gampopa had this particular quality himself. He was able somehow or other, through his realization and his great skill in communication, to open up the Dharma directly to people. So a spiritual friend as an ordinary human being is pretty special. He's not going to be your mate or anything like that. And you might wonder how on earth you would find somebody like that. How would you know? Of course, you'd only know this through getting to know someone very deeply indeed over a long period of time. You could only really see whether they had such qualities if you were around them for a long time. So Gampopa also speaks, making it even more practical, he talks more simply still, again quoting a traditional Indian source. He says that spiritual friend is first of all someone well versed in the message of the Mahayana, and secondly he follows the precepts of a Bodhisattva. By Mahayana, we mean the great way. That's how you translate that, the great way. If you read books on Buddhism, they'll tell you Mahayana sounds like a particular sort of sect as opposed to the little way and all that sort of thing. But Gampopa is not being sectarian here. He doesn't mean Mahayana in that sense. He means someone who knows the breadth and depth of Buddhism in theory and practice. The Mahayana tradition emphasizes that the spiritual path, the Buddhist life, is not lived for oneself alone. You practice it, you live it for the benefit of all beings. Sangharakshita speaks of the Mahayana as that aspect
of the Buddhist tradition that makes clear that there is no limit, no end to spiritual unfoldment. There's no end, there's no limit, because there's no end to living beings. So Mahayana is concerned not only with liberation, with wisdom, but also with the development and cultivation of love and compassion for all. And of course, this is the Buddha's original message. So a spiritual friend is someone well versed in the breadth and depth of Buddhist practice, not as ideas, but being inspired by it, moved by it. And secondly, the spiritual friend follows the Bodhisattva precepts. The spiritual friend is someone committed to the training, who's following the training of the path of wisdom and compassion, and is actually living that life. So Gampopa doesn't speak here of any kind of levels of spiritual friend. So perhaps you could say, really bringing it closer to home, spiritual friends are those who are seriously committed to the spiritual life, to enlightenment for the benefit of all. They're committed to it and they're communicating its nature to you. And this was what was so striking about my first contact with spiritual friends, with members of the Western Buddhist Order. They weren't gurus. They weren't, as far as I know, highly spiritually advanced. They certainly didn't claim to be. But they exemplified, for me, serious spiritual commitment. And they demonstrated it in their lives, and they communicated from that. Buddhadasa in his jeans led my first puja, and I eventually lived with him, was a tremendous, and it still is, a tremendous example to me. Very early in the morning when I moved in with him, when I lived with him, I remember the first morning waking up and I heard him doing his morning practice, which would take about 2.5 to 3 hours. I heard him first of all doing 108 prostrations to a visualization of different Buddha figures. I heard him chanting. I heard silence, because a lot of the time he was sitting in silent meditation. Sometimes he'd do a similar session in the evening. That's when he wasn't leading, you know, 2 or 3 classes a week and a study group. And in the day, he'd be meeting people who came to the centre and doing practical work, improving our little centre. And he was funding all these things out of his own pocket. He'd come into a bit of money and he was just spending it all on this centre. And also, he was friendly, approachable and ordinary. He definitely was not a guru. When I tried to make him a guru, he wouldn't let me make him a guru. He was just a man living his life. So he was a great example and inspiration to me. And I met a number of other members of our order who were very much like this. And I'm very glad that I had that opportunity. I'm very glad that I have such spiritual friends. And of course, spiritual friends like this don't invite a passive relationship. You get involved in the Sangha that they're a part of. And that's what happened to me. I got involved in their Sangha, practicing and working with them and imbibing, learning the Bodhisattva path, engaging in serious, thorough spiritual practice, and sharing that with my friends in the Sangha. Now, I want to point that out, because one of the things that Gampopa doesn't really talk about in terms of spiritual friends is your fellows in the spiritual life. He emphasises teachers and being a disciple. But there's a whole dimension of spiritual life and of spiritual friendship, which is just practising and being with others who are also practising. So it's a very significant aspect of spiritual friendship, which is a big feature of our own Sangha. It's a particular aspect of Sangha that Sangharakshita has really drawn out. So this point about not being passive in relation to spiritual friends is important, because after describing the qualities of spiritual friends, Gampopa talks about the ways in which you approach spiritual friends and stay in touch with spiritual friends. In other words, how you communicate with them. And here, as elsewhere, Gampopa is being very traditional indeed. First of all, he says, you remain in touch with your spiritual friend by receiving him respectfully. And he says that means you fold your hands, you rise quickly in his presence, you bow down to him, you circumambulate him, you speak only at the proper time, and you gaze at him lovingly, not satisfied with just one glance. And you serve him, you provide him with clothes and food and all the necessities of life, whatever the trouble to you. Well, again, this is very traditional Eastern context, not just Buddhist, I should say, and not just in relation to a spiritual life. If you were to study under an ustad, a guru, an acharya, if you were to learn music, Indian music, for example, you'd have to have the same sort of relationship with the person teaching you music. I don't think, in relation to Buddhist practice, that we can expect this sort of thing in the West, certainly not from the outset. Maybe something like that you might feel, you might express, but only after a while. And I certainly don't think that this sort of thing should be expected or demanded. Sangha Akshita never expects it, and he never demands it. And I've sometimes felt like bowing to Sangha Akshita and sort of try to do it, and it sort of doesn't quite work. He just wants to meet you, just wants to get into communication with you. And he certainly thinks it shouldn't be insisted upon. Having said that, there is a principle, I think, behind this. There is a spiritual point, and it's a very simple point, really. To be able to receive spiritual friendship, to be able to receive instruction and inspiration, to really take it in, you need to be friendly yourself towards spiritual friends. It's a very simple point. You need to be friendly and interested and receptive and welcoming and courteous in relation to them, as you would be to any other human being, really. Now, I say this because sometimes I have had the experience of people sort of either passively expecting to be given a teaching. They sort of sit there and it's like they're expecting you to do something. You know, it's like, well, you're a Buddhist, you know, entertain me through, you know, giving me some fantastic instruction, feed me. Well, it just doesn't work like that. You can't communicate to somebody when they're in that sort of passive state. Or sometimes there's a sort of demand that they've got a sort of right to you giving them a teaching. Remember once in India, on a train in India, a man, I mean, more or less almost coming to the point where he wanted to attack me physically because he wanted me to tell me what my understanding of Buddhism was. And it was obvious he wasn't receptive. He wasn't interested, actually. So he was getting more and more aggressive in relation to me because I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't think it was the right time. The point is, for the Dharma to be communicated, we need the right kind of atmosphere. There needs to be real interest, serious interest in spiritual practice. If we really want to receive instruction, we need to be seriously interested in spiritual practice. And there needs to be warmth and friendliness. And everybody needs to be involved in the communication. Yes, there might be, you know, one person doing most of the teaching, put that in single inverted commas, and maybe we're listening. But we're all really involved as people, treating each other as people, where there's mutual care and concern. Then the Dharma can really begin to manifest between one another. One of the ways Sangha Akshita speaks of the Sangha, the Buddhist spiritual community, is with this very interesting phrase. A Sangha is a vital mutual responsiveness, where you're involved with one another in a deep searching exploration of the spiritual life together in complete harmony and honesty, and where the thought of teacher and taught has been forgotten. You're so intensively involved in this exploration of things together. Nobody's bothered about who is the teacher and who's the taught. So that's what we're looking for. The second way of staying in touch with a spiritual friend, Gampopa mentions, is even more demanding and even stranger to our ears. You remain in touch with him by showing him
devoted interest and reverence. And this means, says Gampopa, to think of your spiritual friend as the Buddha, as the enlightened one. You awaken reverence for him and be bounteous to him and please him. Now, we have to take great care here. I think we're on very, very tricky ground indeed. In the Tibetan tradition, it's taken literally. Your guru is the Buddha. So you obey him and follow him. But I have to say, I've got real doubts about the wisdom of this in the West, and even doubts about it in the East too. Maybe in the old India, the old Tibet, you've got a highly traditional culture. And in the old Tibet, at best, you've got this, the archetypal is kind of woven into the fabric of life. You imbibe that with your mother's milk. And maybe you do develop a very, very profound faith and a very deep spiritual vision and imagination. And yes, maybe you do then see your teacher as the Buddha, especially perhaps in a ritual context, especially in meditation, especially perhaps in dreams. But this, I don't think, is to be spoken of. This is certainly not to be advertised. Unfortunately, this is happening in the West. You pick up a Buddhist magazine, say Tricycle, and you get these adverts of lamas coming over or roshis coming over, and they're described as living Buddhas and all this sort of thing. I think that's very, very unfortunate. That's a real betrayal, actually, of the tradition, to turning it into advertising. You might think it's a sort of skillful means, but actually I think it's the betrayal of actually what can be a very, very profound and deep spiritual vision. But it's something of great sort of spiritual intimacy, if you like. It's very much of the heart. It reflects this kind of vision of things, a very different vision of life, a vision of reality, perfuming all experience. It's almost like the Blakean, seeing eternity in a grain of sand or something like that. It's not something, you know, to be sort of trotted out in the marketplace. Having said that, you might find, as you practice and meet spiritual friends, that you not only respect them, you might find yourself revering them, just through your experience of them. The word for reverence in Sanskrit is Gaurava, Gaurava, which comes from a root meaning weight, heavy even. And I take this to mean that, well, that person carries spiritual weight for you. So of course you revere them. They have, based on your experience of them, they carry some real spiritual weight, because their teaching is so clear, because they're so inspirational, because of the way they live. And you sort of sense a depth about them, an otherness about them. You won't not say that they're Buddhas or anything like that, but you know, they have that effect on you, and they spark you off, and they take your spiritual aspiration very, very seriously. And this can be very, very powerful when you, you know, if you're in touch with somebody who you have reverence and respect for, and they take you very seriously, has a tremendous effect on you. And this is why I regard Sangharakshita as my teacher and spiritual friend. I've absolutely no idea of his spiritual level, and I'm not actually interested in his spiritual level. And he makes no claims at all. But for me, he has the kind of qualities I've mentioned. For me, he's opened up the path in a very clear and straightforward way. He's inspired me. And at various times, I've found him sparking off, if you like, my spiritual energies. And very importantly, he's taken my spiritual aspiration very, very seriously. It's very powerful when a spiritual friend, someone you respect and revere, takes your aspiration completely seriously. When they witness it and point to it and affirm it, it really releases a lot of energy. It's one of the great benefits of having spiritual friends. The third way you stay in touch with spiritual friends, Gampopa says, is to establish the validity of their teachings through studying them, contemplating them, and through experiencing them, making them a living experience. And of all the ways to stay in touch with a spiritual friend, this is the most important of all. Forget everything else.
This is the most important. You engage with what he teaches and practices, and you make that an actual experience. It's interesting, I can go for weeks, months, even years without seeing some of my spiritual friends in our order, in our Sangha. But when we meet, we're not starting again. Very mysterious, this. We're not even picking up where we left off. It's actually as if the friendship has got deeper, the spiritual friendship has got deeper, because we're both studying and reflecting upon and experiencing the Dharma. We're practicing the same Dharma. This is a very wonderful and magical thing. Spiritual friendship can result, if you seriously practice, in a connection that transcends time and space. Spiritual friends, because all they really want is that we practice the Dharma, are not people who necessarily draw attention to themselves. So when we talk about spiritual friendship, we're not talking about a cult of personality. They point us and direct us towards the Dharma, one of the great reliances, the four great reliances that the Mahayana teach and that Sangharakshita has emphasized, is rely on the Dharma, not on personalities. Spiritual friends point us to the path of liberation, and we really meet them and we really know them, we really get close to them, to the extent that we're on that path. What precisely they teach, according to Gampopa, we will discover tomorrow. At least some of the things we'll discover tomorrow. So I'll just conclude this rather long talk. Gampopa stresses that our greatest benefactor is the spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being. He is our greatest benefactor because he is the one that we first meet. He is the one that we recognise. So he's the first spiritual friend. And of course, could be the plural, spiritual friends. It's actually a very beautiful point, this. There's a real beauty in it. When you reflect on it, it draws, because it's drawing our attention to those who have helped us on our way, on our journey. And when we think about it, we've had many, many teachers, actually. I spoke about my first meetings, mainly in terms of meeting spiritual friends, in terms of meeting Buddhist practitioners, members of our order. But listening to John Coltrane was meeting a spiritual friend. Reading the works of Lama Govinda was meeting a spiritual friend. There are so many friends, actually. Maybe they don't know that they're our spiritual friends. But they have been spiritual friends to us. It's very interesting, when we have our ordination retreats, we have long ordination retreats, 4-month-long retreats. When people go to when they're building up to their own ordination ceremony, they often find themselves reflecting, because it's such a momentous event for them, they often find themselves reflecting on their teachers and friends. And they discover that there are just so many people who've helped them in their life to get to that point. And not just Buddhist people or anything like that. There's so many people who are teachers and friends. So when we reflect like this, when we form, we actually start to form a receptive, eager to learn, sort of training attitude to life. Actually everything, not just everybody, but everything begins to become a teacher, begins to become a spiritual friend. We can even have the profound insight of everything being a teacher. Everything is teaching something. Everything is a spiritual friend if we could see it in the right way. And here we come to the famous story of Gampopa's teacher, Milarepa. Milarepa spent years and years in solitary meditation. And one of his only possession, really, apart from his cotton robe, was a clay pot. So he would live up in the mountains in a cave, and he'd go and gather his nettles. And he'd just boil up his nettle broth in this clay pot. That's what he lived on. That's why he was blue-tinged or green-tinged, because of all the nettle broth that he lived on. One day he left his cave and
He tripped. He was so weak from his ascetic life. He tripped over and the handle of the pot broke. And he saw the pot just rolling away down the mountain, just smashing down the mountain. And a single green piece in the form of the pot sort of was ejected. This was the residue of the nettle broth that was kind of in the form of a pot. And he just watched that pot descending down the mountain. He tried to go after it for a bit, but he just watched it, his only possession, disappearing and breaking. And as Milarepa watched, he marvelled at what he saw, and then he sang his song. He was a great singer as well as a great meditator, Milarepa. At the same moment, I had a pot, and then I didn't have a pot. This shows the whole truth of the impermanence of everything. Especially, it reveals the human condition. So I, the hermit Milarepa, will strive to meditate without distraction. That precious pot containing all my wealth becomes my guru in the very moment that it breaks. This teaching on the inherent impermanence of all things is a great marvel. Even a broken pot can be a meeting with a spiritual friend.